News. I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next. Welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On this Holocaust Remembrance Day, I am replaying a memorable conversation that I recorded almost 20 years ago with a Holocaust survivor by the name of Edith Eisenberg, who died back in 2012. She was born in Stuttgart, Germany in 1930, and she and her parents, Hans and Elsa Stenheim, narrowly escaped Germany in 1939. Emigrating to the United States, where she eventually married, became a registered nurse, and even served for a time as director of student health services at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, a beloved member of the community and of the many Holocaust survivors with whom I've been privileged to speak over the years. None left as deep an impression on me as did Edith Eisenberg, with her poignant, heartfelt account of what she and her parents experienced.
Ahead of our talking about your story, I'd like to hear a little bit about how over the years you have told your story. You mentioned before we began that this is also actually something that you and your husband would do on a number of occasions, that is, share your story of escaping the Holocaust. Talk for a moment about how much you've done this over the years and what this experience has been like, that is, the experience of telling your story to others.
I started, at first it was very hard for me. I was too emotional about what had happened, and I was not ready to share it as early as my husband was. But after a while, when we got invitations to talk to schools, and we especially liked to talk to children because we felt that we wanted for them to hear the story firsthand, it became easier. Hmm. And now I'm 78 years old, and I'm very fearful that the story of the Holocaust is going to be lost. Not only are the Holocaust survivors dying, but the liberators of the camps who saw firsthand what happened are also dying.
Hmm. I remember at Kenosha's most recent Holocaust Remembrance Day, their guest was a gentleman by the name of Nate Toffel, and he would be very similar to you in age. And I remember him mentioning in the course of our interview that this was something that he, over the years, talked very infrequently about, but that it has been important for him in recent years, as older Holocaust survivors pass away, for him and for his peers to, in a sense, pick up the mantle of responsibility to share this story. And it sounds like you feel some of that responsibility as well.
I feel the same way. I always depended upon my father, who was a writer, to tell the story. And he wrote a book and did tell the story. But then when I think now the mantle has passed to me, and I think I feel a real sense that this is something I want to do.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in passing that you and your husband actually, in addition to sharing your story with school groups and various civic groups, also shared your story as part of Steven Spielberg's Shoah project. Tell us when you did that and what that experience was like.
I can't tell you exactly how many years ago that was. I would say around 15 years ago when Steven Spielberg conceived the idea of collecting the stories of Holocaust survivors all over the world, actually. And we decided that when we did this, we wanted to have more information, and we actually collected and organized some of our family history and our own history. Now, today I just came in without doing anything. I'm just going to talk to you from what I remember.
Sure.
But it was the interviewers were, an interviewer came from Chicago, and she made the interviewers each. She came twice. She came one day, the day before, and explained everything and told us the kind of material that she thinks would be helpful. And because it's a video, she also asked whether we had anything that we would like to show. And I collected pictures of my family, pictures of family who had died in concentration camps, and other memorabilia that I had saved, like a German passport with a large J in it, meaning for standing for Jude. Because at that time, when I was a child, all the papers, everything had to have a J if you were Jewish. And I had other papers like that, too. And so did my husband.
So now, because you and your husband recorded those stories as part of the Shoah Project, these are stories that can be seen and heard by people who choose to access them.
Exactly, exactly.
We're speaking today with Edith Eisenberg, and she makes her home now in Racine. We're going to be hearing her story of being born and raised for a time in Germany, and then the story of she and her parents escaping with their lives to make a new life for themselves here in America. You were born in 1930 in Stuttgart, Germany. Tell us what your earliest memories are of Stuttgart. I assume the earliest memories are probably largely happy ones.
I agree with, yes, definitely happy ones. My father and mother and my maternal grandparents lived in Stuttgart, where my father and my grandfather owned a Jewish newspaper, and they were, my parents and grandparents were very much involved in the community, and my grandfather was also a theater critic, but I couldn't go anymore because as Jews we weren't admitted anymore. But I had my life, and I think when I was trying to think back when I first as a child realized that something was wrong, I don't think at that time I knew the name Nazis yet. But I knew that my life was changing. And I think probably one of the first things that really brought it home to me is that when all of a sudden, just out of nowhere, when I would meet Margaret, she wouldn't even talk to me. She just absolutely walked away as if she, as just like she didn't know me. And I was very hurt by it, and I asked my mother about it, and my mother said, my mother then told me a little bit about what was going on and said she's sure that it's not anything between Margaret and me, but it's the circumstances. And one day my mother and I were walking, and Margaret's mother came up to us, and I remember it because it was really eerie. You could tell she was afraid, and she just whispered into my mother's ear, and my mother told me afterwards, she said, I just want you to know that if it were up to me, Margaret and Edith could keep on playing, she said, but Hans, and that was their son, she said, Hans joined the Hitler Youth, and he's going to report us if Margaret plays with a Jewish friend. So that was one of the first times that I learned really firsthand what was going on, because I think my parents, like so many of the other parents, try to protect us.
Sure. I was going to say that had, I mean, on top of the central difficulty, which was of the real life situation confronting the Jews in Germany, also the sort of smaller crisis which confronted parents all across Germany about, what do I tell little Margaret or whoever the child is who's asking, why can't I play with my best friend anymore? I mean, how much to say or how to characterize what had to be so bewildering even to them as adults.
As I grew older and as I had children of my own, I always marveled at how well my parents handled the situation, because I don't really remember ever being frightened. And I don't know what, in similar circumstances, I would have been so afraid. I would have been afraid to let my children out of my sight, that, or I would have said things that would most likely have scared them. So I really admired that.
So they were able to share at least a little information to try to help explain this, but not so much that it was truly frightening. Were you ever able to reconnect with your friend Margaret?
No, no.
You were never able to play again.
I was back in Germany several times, and I did go back to where we lived, but they were no longer there.
How much, as this first started to become evident to you that something was amiss, something was afoot, how much were you talking about this with your young Jewish friends, your classmates, for instance, in the Jewish school? I assume this started to become something that was a source of fear for a lot of you.
I don't remember per se talking about it with them. There were things happened that, in later years, that was more closer to 1939, when school was let out, we would always have Hitler Youth in front of our school chanting, dirty Jew, or threatening us. And we were afraid of that, and the school then decided that they were going to not have a specific time of letting us all go, and parents came at intervals and picked us up.
So there wouldn't be this set dismissal time at such and such a time.
Exactly.
So that kind of ugly scene could be avoided.
I think more so than talking about the situation, we talked about it indirectly, because there's a German word, Auswanderung. It means emigration. And that word, we heard that word all the time. That was the word that our parents talked about, because everybody was looking for a way out.
When it became clear that this was a frightening situation.
Exactly.
With no clear or quick resolution, this would be a solution, in a sense, then for a family fearing for its future.
And anytime you had a group of Jewish friends or Jewish family together, that was the topic of conversation, immigration.
Tell us a little bit about what I assume you experienced at some point in terms of this kind of encroachment into your daily lives and the barriers which began to be erected. We hear so much about that, about how suddenly one day you couldn't swim in such and such a pool anymore, that kind of thing. What recollections do you have of that?
Well, my first recollection is, I have to tell you, I loved ice cream. And there was a store on Main Street, and Stuttgart's a big city. It's about the size of Milwaukee, I would guess. But there was a store on the Main Street. It was called the Ice Cream Cone. I'm translating it now from the German. And about once a week, my mother would take me down there, and I would have an ice cream cone. And one day when we got there, there was a sign on the door. And it said, Juden unerwünscht, Jews
not wanted,
not welcome. And that was the first store. And then more and more stores would put up these signs. And pretty soon we were really only able to shop at Jewish stores. We stayed home much more. We went out as little as possible, because I guess my parents didn't feel safe. We didn't talk about it, but I know we went out less and less. And I couldn't go to the movies anymore and things like that. And we avoided any kind of crowd. And there were always parades. And I always wanted to see the parade.
Mm.
But what children want to see parades.
Sure, even if it was a Nazi parade.
And my mother would always, you know, say, no, no, we can't, and would take me the other way.
Wow. I mean, partly she, of course, would object to the parade itself, but probably also feared for your safety.
Exactly.
If you were seen there.
Yeah.
Wow. Of course, one of the really dramatic, frightening events in this dark time was this night that's come to be known as Kristallnacht. And I know you have some very specific recollections of that. First of all, remind our listeners of when that occurred and why.
That was the night of November 9th to November 10th. A German attaché in France was murdered, and I have to check this, by a Jew, and this supposedly was the reason for Kristallnacht, but it's pretty much believed that this just didn't happen from one night to the other, that this had been planned. Mm.
But this was the official story given by the German government, that because this terrible act supposedly was committed by a Jew against a German official in France, that then this reprisal should occur.
Exactly, but I have to check that out.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not quite sure of the details.
Mm-hmm.
The way I remember Kristallnacht is that I told you before that I went to a Jewish school, and the Jewish school was right next to the synagogue. And we didn't live very far from the Jewish school. Actually, we left our home and moved into my grandparents' apartment, which was adjacent to the offices of the Jewish newspaper, my parents' father's Jewish newspaper. And we got a call early in the morning, and it was a friend who said that my parents be sure not to send me to school, because it would be too dangerous because the synagogue was burning. And I went to the window because I could see the synagogue from our back bedroom window, and I could see the smoke coming from that area.
Mm.
That was the very first thing. Then all day long, different people would call or would stop in, and they would say that arrests were being made. And in Stuttgart, all the Jewish stores, there were quite a few Jewish stores on Main Street, that all of their window panes were shattered. And that's how Kristallnacht got its name, because there were so many shards of glass on the street that in the sunlight they sparkled like crystal. Mm. And I saw that myself.
Mm.
And I'll tell you how I got to see that. But different people would come, and they would say that Jewish men were being arrested, and they were talking about what to do. Would it be better to hide, or would it be better to stay put? And that afternoon, the doorbell rang, and I answered the door, and we had I've never seen it in this country, but it was just like a little cubbyhole that you spoke through.
Oh.
It reminded me of the kind of boxes we had for milk delivery here.
Oh.
And I went and I asked who it was, and there were three men standing there, and they asked for my grandfather, and this is really very personal. I don't think I've ever talked about this before. It just came to mind. They asked for my grandfather, and I said my grandfather died, and would they like to speak to my father? And I always blamed myself. For years and years, I felt very, very guilty, because I had the idea that if I had said that my grandfather had died and had not said, would you like to speak to my father, that they would have gone away.
Ah.
And I've never told that. I don't think I've ever told that to anyone. It just happened in my mind.
Wow. So you were, in a sense, suggesting or offering that I your father just, could talk.
Yeah, exactly.
And tell us what that ultimately led to.
So these three Gestapo came in, and at that time, the way I recognized Gestapo was that they all wore trench coats. Pretty much like the raincoats we wear today. And they were very polite. And they came in and they simply said, asked my father to identify himself, and said that he should come with them. Absolutely no other information to my mother or to me. And my father left. And that was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and that afternoon my mother was on the phone trying to find out, you know, where, asking other friends whether their husbands had been arrested and where they could possibly be, but there was no information available at all. And my mother immediately, I remember she immediately wrote a letter to my grandmother and my aunt and uncle in the United States. And I was sitting with her, and she thought and thought how to word it. She was afraid to tell them that he was arrested, but she wanted them to know that what had happened. And she found a way of wording it like that he was... You could have taken it that he was on vacation, that he was away from home. But I think they said that they knew immediately what she meant.
So she was trying to say it without saying it.
Yeah, exactly. And this aunt and uncle are the ones who brought us to the United States. It wasn't easy to get into any foreign country at that time because... the people who would sponsor you had to, first of all, they had to be off well enough financially so that they could take care of you. And they had to sign papers saying that you would never become wards of the state, that they would always take care of you. And my aunt and uncle had just left Germany a year and a half before that.
And had they left, I mean... purposefully because of this changing situation there? I mean, they didn't just leave for the sake of leaving.
No.
They were, in a sense, fleeing this frightening situation.
My aunt and uncle's story is a little bit different. My uncle was not Jewish. And he was the publisher-editor of a relatively large German newspaper. And he was told... sometime in 1936, I think, that he had a choice to make, that he needed to either divorce my aunt, because they knew that she was Jewish, or that they would terminate his position. Mm-hmm. And at that time, they decided together that they would come to the United States.
Where they could remain married.
Where they could remain married, and my uncle, he didn't want to have any part of Germany.
Hmm. Let's return to your father. So he is taken away by these three men. It sounds like they never really say the word "you are arrested." But
I don't remember it.
Right? Yeah. So they take him away. So what happened to your father at that point?
Well, that night, that very night at 12 o'clock, it was at 12 o'clock. The doorbell rang, and my mother didn't know what to do.
Hmm.
But she decided to find out, you know, who was there. And we had, I don't remember for sure, knew between 8 or 12 men appear, again with their trench coats on. But always each one of them showing their identification. And I don't think that struck me as anything unusual at all then. But now it shows... when I think about it, it showed how all this was perpetrated in a way that was methodical and correct. They didn't just storm in.
Right. There was not a chaotic scene.
No, they just very quietly came, showed their identification. And they said they came, they wanted to search the offices. I told you that were adjoining our apartment.
Right.
And they went in to look through the papers, and I went with them. I just stood around and watched. And
really?
My parents were always amazed because I remember details that they didn't remember.
Hmm.
And I think that I wasn't really fearful at that time. I was just observant. And I had a doll. I was carrying a doll, and one of the Gestapo men came over to me and asked me the name of my doll and talked to me very nicely, told me that he had a little girl, too.
Hmm.
And then a few of them left and said they were going to pick up my father. Now, we thought maybe that sounded good. They were going to bring him back home.
Hmm.
But what they actually did is they brought him back because they had questions about the office.
And about the newspaper, I assume.
About the newspaper. And my father told me years later, he said he was never afraid at that moment because he said he knew that all of his papers, everything was in perfect order. And they asked a lot of questions about the subscribers because the people who advertised in the paper, because actually what I didn't tell you is that it was shortly before then that the decree came out that German Jewish newspapers couldn't be published anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So everything was at a standstill. And My father showed them around and answered their questions. I don't remember what the questions were. I wouldn't have understood them. And then one of the men said to my mother, they said, why don't you pack a little suitcase for him to take along? And they said, personal items and clothes. And my mother and I went, we packed this little suitcase. And then they, just before they were taking my father away again, they closed the two office doors that led to the apartment, and they applied a red seal of wax to the doors.
Really?
And they said that if that seal of wax gets broken, that could mean my mother's arrest and death.
Wow.
They really, and my mother was a very practical woman. I don't know how she did it. The minute they left, she said, we're going to move a big piece of furniture in front of that door. She said, that way no one will bump into it.
Mm.
And it will open, not be opened by mistake.
Wow.
I just think that's unbelievable.
Yeah. A smart woman.
That she could do that. And my mother was actually a very timid woman.
Mm.
And then I realized that things were really serious at that when my father left. Because in the Jewish religion, before every holiday, because our holidays start the evening before the eve, or also the Sabbath, the father in an observant home blesses the children. And my father blessed me, called me over, and he put his hands on my head, and he blessed me. And I knew it wasn't the Sabbath, and I knew it wasn't a Jewish holiday. So I knew that something really serious.
Just in that little gesture from him.
That little gesture.
Wow. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Edith Eisenberg. She is sharing some recollections of her experience of growing up in Stuttgart, Germany, and the experience, which we will be talking about shortly, of her family leaving Stuttgart to escape the rising storm clouds of Nazism and to make their way here to the United States for a new life. So your father was, in effect, arrested. Where was he taken?
He was taken to the city jail.
And how long was he there?
He was in the city jail. he was taken, he was, overnight, he went back to the city jail again, and the next day he was taken to Dachau. Now, my mother and I went down to the police that morning. The next morning, we went to the police station. We went to all the offices that she thought she might be able to get some information where he was taken. And at that time, we didn't know. And the reason I told you that I saw what Kristallnacht looked like is because that morning on the way to the police headquarters, we had to go downtown. And I saw all the stores that had been damaged and the shards of glass all over. Mm. And just before my father left, he asked my mother to go to Bensheim. That's the little town where my grandparents lived. And he said, please go and see that they're all right. And after we made the rounds of all these stations and saw so many other Jewish women and children there, just
in the same situation,
in the same situation, trying to get information, we went to the railroad station, and Bensheim, well, Stuttgart is a major railroad center for all of Germany still today, and we were able to get a train to Bensheim, and we went to Bensheim, and we arrived. It was already dark. And it was so strange, because whenever I came to visit, my grandfather would be at the station picking me up, and my mother and father, and he always had a big bag of candy for me. Or he might have one of the dogs with him. And here we were alone, and it was dark, and we walked to their house, and the whole house was dark, and my mother knocked and knocked, and no one answered, and she was persistent. She kept on knocking. Then finally, my grandmother came to the door.
Mm. Probably wondering what this knock on the door was. I mean, for a Jewish family at that point in time, that had to be a frightening
sound.
It
must have been very frightening. And we learned, the minute she saw us, she started to cry, and she said that my grandfather had been taken away that morning, that he had been arrested. And then she told us that theirs was the only Jewish home. From what she heard, it was a small town, what she heard, that had not been vandalized, that they had been saved from that. And the next morning, my mother and I went to see other relatives in that little town, and their houses were all in shambles. Mm. Everything wrecked. Mm. And everybody just really, really frightened.
Wow. And for you, I mean, you're 8 years old at the time.
And I think we stayed long enough. There wasn't anything we could do for my grandmother. But we found out within a few days that my grandfather had been taken to Buchenwald. And we went back to Stuttgart, and there we learned that my father was in Dachau. Mm-hmm. And also learned that many of my friends' parents told us, you know, fathers were in Dachau. And
now, at that moment in time, I assume that the name Dachau did not mean to you what it means now. I mean,
it meant nothing. It was another jail. Mm-hmm. That I've learned from my mother now. My father said that he had known of Dachau, and he said that when they were on the bus trip, you know, from the jail to Dachau, he said several of the men who were on the bus trip knew by the direction that the bus was going, the general direction, and Dachau is near Munich, that they knew that where they were going to go. Hmm. And then Dorothy was telling you about my father's book before. He wrote about his concentration camp experience, among other things. So I learned a lot firsthand about what happened. And this was 1938. This was before the decision had been made to exterminate the Jews.
How long was he in Dachau?
6 weeks.
6 weeks. I think one of the things that is hardest for us to grasp is how awful it would be to be caught in something so frightening where you knew so little. I mean, not just you as a child, but even your mother. That had to be so awful to not only have these terrible things happening, but to know so little about what exactly happened and why it happened and what's going to happen next. I mean, to live with that sort of acute sense of uncertainty had to be so difficult. I wonder if you, however, as a child, were at least to some extent insulated from that, if that was maybe worse for somebody like your mother.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. Because I remember meeting my friends and playing with them, and their fathers were gone too. And when I think of what my mother did, my mother immediately went to the American consulate, and by that time, there was an American consulate in Stuttgart. I mean, there were hundreds of Jewish women out and men and lined out outside trying to get help, trying to see if they had any chance of coming to the United States. And our papers had already been initiated. And after many days, my mother was able to get a statement from them, from the consulate, saying that most likely our papers would be ready to leave Germany for the United States in February. And based on that, my father was released after 6 weeks.
Mm. Because at that point, Germany was as mostly interested in just having you leave.
Exactly, exactly. And Germany wanted us to leave, and for most families, there was no place to go.
You've touched on the fact that this whole word, German word for immigration, whatever that word is, was, I mean, that was a word you heard all the time. And you talk about it being, in a sense, an exciting prospect. I mean, and of course, it would perhaps mean escaping this thing, which seemed more and more frightening. How did you greet this possibility? I mean, were you excited at the possibility or saddened or both?
I was looking forward to seeing my grandmother and my aunt and uncle in the United States. I felt that this was a very, very important thing for us to leave. I also heard from my friends how worried their parents were because they had no place to go to. And then it was all made very, very clear when one of the teachers at the at my school, now we weren't going to school anymore at that time because the synagogue was, as I told you, was lit and it was almost completely destroyed, and it was too dangerous to walk by there because of the rocks falling off the synagogue. It was a pretty massive building.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the teachers at our school had twin sons, and he and his wife and the twin, they all committed suicide. And my parents did tell me why. They committed suicide because their papers have come to the United States were denied, and they didn't know where else they could go.
Wow.
And I think that shook all of us unbelievably.
Wow. It made the possibility of leaving, of emigrating to the United States, literally a matter of life and death. So how long a waiting period are we talking about between this concerted effort your parents made to arrange this and the time when finally you were able to depart?
Well, trying to make arrangements for us to come to the United States. And there were some difficulties because my aunt and uncle had recently emigrated, and there wasn't, didn't have enough money to vouch for us, so they had to find other family members. And it was amazing. There were distant family members who were Americans who were willing to do that for them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that was to take out a family and say, we'll take care of them, someone you've never known, mm-hmm. never written to before. They were busy in the United States trying to find people to bring us that, but I would say actually we left in March, and my father was arrested and discharged in December, so it was only about January, February, March. It was only really about 3 months.
What do you remember about your preparations to leave, and for instance, packing up? I mean, were you trying to pack up nearly everything you owned, or was that not possible?
Someplace along that, I don't know when, we had to hand over all valuables like jewelry, silverware, gold. That was collected. We had to go
to the government, you mean?
To the government. We went and dropped these things off at the police station. And you could still take out, you could still make arrangements to have your things shipped over to the United States. And my mother and father were making the arrangements. I remember them saying that if we can't bring anything out, we'll leave. They said, we'll leave everything behind and just go with what we have on our backs.
So leaving was the most important thing.
Leaving was definitely the most important thing.
So tell us everything you remember about the actual departure.
My father wanted us to leave very, very... I think before... one of the hardest things, and I always tear up when I talk about it, is that my grandparents didn't have the papers to come to the United States, and we had to leave them behind.
The grandparents?
My father's parents.
In Bensheim.
Right, and I think one of the hardest things was the goodbyes.
Mm. So you went to Bensheim?
They came to Stuttgart, and everybody put on a smile because of me. And of course, at that time, I don't think my parents knew about extermination camps. I mean, at that time, there was still a chance that they would get out. But I found things out for myself very often, and things that my parents didn't even think influenced me in my thinking did. And one of the things that struck me at that time is that we were conservative, and in the conservative Jewish religion, it's customary for children not to go to the cemetery while their parents are still alive. So when my mother went to the cemetery to visit the grave of her father, I never went along. I knew where the cemetery was, but I had never seen it. And I heard my mother talking to my grandfather, that was my father's father, and she said, you know, I really would like Edith, they called me Edith, the diminutive, to see my father's grave. She said, and I don't know what to do about it. And I remember my grandfather telling her, I think under these circumstances, I think it would be perfectly all right.
Such a thing would be allowed.
It wasn't really allowed. It was more a custom rather than...
Right. So it would be understood that this would be okay.
So my mother took me along to the cemetery. And then my grandparents died in a concentration camp, and there was no cemetery to go to anymore. So, and I've been back to that cemetery with my children.
Really?
Several times.
Wow.
So that was one of the last things we did before we left from Germany. Came the goodbyes. My father and mother decided that someplace along the line that, and this was very important because so many people wanted to leave Germany, it was just absolutely essential that you booked a passage on a boat in time. And my father said that he thought the safest thing to do would be to go to an American line, because if we went with a German ship, we were still under the same as being on German ground, he said. So we came to the United States with a ship called the President Roosevelt. And this ship left from Germany and then went to France, and there was an interval of a week it left Germany and then came to France. And my parents said, well, we were not even going to stay in Germany. We're going to go to France.
Mm. And we're going to... And wait there.
Wait there, because that would be a lot safer.
Yeah. So they wanted to get off of German soil and away from German authority as quickly as possible.
Exactly. And I have the papers at home, actually. I think I still have the letter. You just couldn't go to France and stay there a week. It took a lot of paperwork to get permission from the French government to even stay there for a week. And again, you had to have a sponsor.
Hmm.
In order to make that sort of intermediary trip.
So we went to France, and...
Did you travel there by train, I assume?
Yeah, we traveled there by train. And, my father said, please don't tell anybody that to me. You know, don't tell your friends we're leaving. We're going to do this quietly. I don't want a lot of people. It would be safer. And we get to the railroad station, there's a whole group of people to see us off.
Oh, dear.
Which was very sweet. They brought candy for me and meant so well, and my father was really, really, really worried.
Mm. That fuss was being made.
Yeah, and the train we took was a train that went from Stuttgart to Strasbourg, and the border crossing was Kiel. And we were on the train, and again, the Gestapo came through and they checked passports, and we were all right. And then and my mother and father told me not to talk to anybody on the train. They didn't want anybody to know that we were leaving. We were just regular passengers on this train.
Mm. So they didn't want you excitedly talking about
looking at, yeah.
Yeah, we're on our way to France and then to America and so on. So to keep that story quiet. Yeah.
And when we got to the border of Kiel, Gestapo again came around and checked our passports, and they took us off the train. Took us off the train, and the train left without us.
Oh.
I didn't have a passport of my own. Mine was combined with my mother. But they came and they took my father's passport. And my father told me later that was the worst moment in his whole experience, when they took his passport at that moment, when we were so close.
Yes.
To leaving for the United States.
You're right on the border between Germany and France.
Right on the border. It was only the Rhine separating us.
Oh.
And my father told my mother that if he doesn't get his passport back, that we should leave without him.
On the next train that
comes
along?
On the next train, which was going to be, I think it was 4 hours.
Mm.
But I remember them saying 4 hours.
The four longest hours of your life, I should think.
But they brought the passport back, which was just like a miracle.
Edith Eisenberg and her parents did manage to escape to France and eventually emigrated to the United States. Edith died back in 2012. If you would like to hear more of this remarkable conversation, I am sharing it in its entirety in the podcast version of The Morning Show. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. And tomorrow on The Morning Show, Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business, pays his monthly visit to The Morning Show to offer his perspective on a number of different topics, including the ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine and the important elections that just occurred in France. Mostly cloudy and cool conditions today. A 40% chance of intermittent light rain all day long and a high of 47 degrees. Cloudy and cool overnight. Slight chance of rain, low of 41. Cloudy tomorrow. Dry as we warm to 56. Saturday, also upper 50s for a high. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine.